The Wittgenstein was infamous for not having read very much in the history of philosophy. In fact, he confessed to his students that he had never read anything by Aristotle. But another friend and student of his, Georg Henrik von Wright, said that Wittgenstein liked Plato and did read and enjoy Plato, and he conjectures that Wittgenstein must have recognized congenial features both in Plato's literary and philosophical method and in the temperament behind the thoughts. I don't know if that's really true, but Wittgenstein's manuscripts contain dozens of mentions of Plato's dialogues or Socrates. So they come up many times either mentioned or alluded to, especially the Theaetetus, but several others as well. And at his death in 1951, among Wittgenstein's belongings were found a five-volume German translation of Plato's dialogues. So Wittgenstein had a lot of interest in and familiarity with Plato's dialogues. Socrates, in Plato's early dialogues, regularly asks, what is X, whether that be virtue or piety or knowledge? And I construe this as a request for a definition. You know, give me the definition of virtue or the definition of knowledge or definition of piety. But Socrates' interlocutors, that is the people he spoke with, initially respond to his request only with examples or instances of the term. So when he asks what is virtue, Meno says, well, there's the virtue of men and there's virtue of husbands and virtue of slaves and so forth. And when Socrates asks Euthyphro, what is piety? Euthyphro famously answers, well, it's what I'm doing right now. And so these are just giving examples or illustrations. They're not really giving definitions. Socrates always responds by pushing the interlocutor for a definition that provides what we would call an essence, or what philosophers would call an essence, a set of necessary and sufficient conditions for the term under discussion. What it is that underlies the instances in virtue of which they are instances of the concept in question. So in the Euthyphro, for example, Socrates says, now, bear in mind, Euthyphro, then, I did not bid you to tell me one or two of the many pious actions, but that form itself that makes all pious actions pious. The interlocutors generally come to see what he's looking for, and they do offer some essence that turns out usually to be either too broad or too narrow, or both. And then discussion proceeds until usually the interlocutor gets tired, or pleads other obligations, and the dialogue generally ends before a satisfactory definition is found. And so these early Socratic dialogues are usually called aporetic dialogues, based on the Greek word aporia, which means puzzlement. They end in puzzlement, no definitions ever found. Socrates, in these early dialogues, does not imagine that these concepts might fail to have an essence, or might not need an essence. Socrates seems not even to consider the possibility that the concept might lack such an essence. But if you think about it, not all concepts can have essences of this sort, short of circularity or infinite regress. So one should always keep in mind that a concept may lack an essence. This line of response to Socrates is Wittgenstein's well-known critique of essentialism regarding the unity of a concept. Wittgenstein tries to reduce our expectations for what is a satisfying resolution of Socrates' question, what is X? So Socrates was always pushing for an essential definition in response, but Wittgenstein wants to get us to accept something less than that. In the Blue Book, which was dictated by Wittgenstein in 1933 and 1934, Wittgenstein warns that what makes it difficult for us to take this line of investigation is our craving for generality and our contemptuous attitude toward the particular. And you can almost hear him directing that comment at Plato and Socrates, who were always interested in sort of generalizing or universalizing or, you know, making more and more abstract, whereas Wittgenstein was more interested in the concrete. So in the philosophical investigations, Wittgenstein addresses this issue this particular issue of defining a term by a discussion of the concept of game. And it's pretty famous. And if you think about it, it's kind of hard to define what a game is. And if you try, you usually come up with something that includes a lot of games but excludes other ones, or ends up including some things that are not games. It's a fun little game to try and define game. And Wittgenstein, anyway, thought that you couldn't ultimately succeed at that. So Wittgenstein sees Socrates' demand for an essence, for a concept, as a compulsion that holds us captive, as something that kind of drives us on and we have trouble escaping. Wittgenstein says, in a way sort of quoting Socrates, Wittgenstein says in Philosophical Investigations 66, he says, there must be something in common, you know, as though the term game wouldn't have any meaning unless you could find that essence that lies behind it that covers all and only those cases that are games. So to escape from this, what he sees as a prejudice that he thinks that Socrates has, to escape from this prejudice, Wittgenstein recommends, don't think, but look. And the idea behind that recommendation is that when you think about something, then you bring with you all of the sort of intellectual baggage of your point of view. But if you look, that is to say, if you kind of look at particular examples, if you see how things are used, that's a way, I think Wittgenstein thought, to sort of bring you back down to earth. Instead of hovering up in the sky with the Platonic forms in the abstract, you're coming down, back down to earth and looking at concrete cases. Thinking leaves us beholden to the temptations of our times, but looking brings us back to earth. And if you do come back to earth, Wittgenstein thought, then we see only, as he said, a complicated network of similarities. So if you were to lay out a bunch of examples of games, Wittgenstein thinks, really what you'd ultimately find is a complicated network of similarities, not a sort of essence. And as he said in a lecture, as Wittgenstein said in a lecture in 1936, he said, we might solve certain puzzles by pointing out that we mustn't look for one common property to be found in all cases. A kinship may be there, but with no common property to which you can point. And this is what Wittgenstein called a family resemblance. And so, whereas Socrates was always pushing for an essence, a set of necessary and sufficient conditions that lie behind a concept, Wittgenstein wanted us to accept that it might be enough just to note a set of resemblances that he calls family resemblances that kind of hold all the examples together. Some have responded to Wittgenstein's position here by trying to offer especially careful definitions of game. And if you look up game on Wikipedia, for example, I mean, if you search the word game on Wikipedia, you'll see that they're trying there to give you an essential definition. Well, even if this were successful, even if someone did come up with a successful essential definition of game, it would not undermine Wittgenstein's point. And here I think, I wish in the lecture that I just quoted from, I wish Wittgenstein hadn't said we mustn't look for an essential definition. I wish Wittgenstein had said we needn't insist on finding an essential definition. Because Wittgenstein surely admits that some terms are definable in essentialist ways. In fact, in the Blue Book, on page 25, when he offers a defining criterion of angina, what he calls angina there, but I think what he means is flu, and at that time angina was a term used for flu, but if you try and figure out what flu is, Wittgenstein says, it's basically a certain bacillus in the bloodstream, a certain virus, viral infection in the bloodstream, and I think it's Wittgenstein should be perfectly happy saying that that is the essential definition of flu, is the presence of a certain virus in the bloodstream. Or if you ask, what is a triangle? And someone said, well, it's a closed plane figure with three straight sides. I think Wittgenstein would say, yeah, that's a good definition. So I don't think Wittgenstein is against the possibility of essential definitions. Rather, what he's against is the idea that all terms must have an essential definition. And he sees this as a sort of Socratic prejudice. Wittgenstein makes similar points, not just about game, but also he talks in similar ways about the notion of goodness in some of his lectures. And in some others of his writings, he mentions the terms punishment, revolution, knowledge, and music as terms that probably could not have essential definitions, terms that we should accept family resemblance accounts of. So anyway, in this kind of debate that I've set up between Socrates on the one hand and Wittgenstein on the other hand, Wittgenstein summed up his position in dictations that he made to Weismann for Moritz Schlick in the early 1930s. Wittgenstein said, "I can characterize my standpoint no better than by saying that it is the opposite standpoint to the one occupied by Socrates in the Platonic dialogues. For if I were asked what knowledge is, I would enumerate instances of knowledge and add the words, and similar things." So Socrates sort of takes the position of the interlocutors that Socrates argues with, and Socrates, Wittgenstein seems to basically endorse their approach by just giving examples and not looking for an essential definition. In a typescript that was at about the same time as these dictations to Schlick, after a similar discussion of Socrates' essentialist expectation and Wittgenstein's own satisfaction with just enumeration and kinship, Wittgenstein remarked parenthetically, "I'm making it easier and easier for myself in philosophy. But the difficulty is to make it easier for oneself and yet to remain precise." So, in a way, it's you might say he's making easy on himself by not pushing all the way for an essentialist definition. And Wittgenstein is here saying, yeah, in a certain way that's easier, but there still is a kind of precision to that, too. Easier, though, by having reduced his expectations for what is required of a legitimate concept. And then a voice in the Philosophical Investigations at section 65 complains, "So, Wittgenstein, you let yourself off the very part of the investigation that once gave you yourself most headache." That voice, I think, is Russell's voice, really. Bertrand Russell had just that sort of complaint about what Wittgenstein was doing in his later philosophy. Anyway, it's an interesting question, I think, how one might decide whether a term was susceptible of an essentialist definition, or when you can let yourself off the term, off the search for an essential definition. And this leaves me with the question, what are we to make of the fact that in the Socratic dialogues, discussion generally ends before a satisfactory definition is found? So I actually want to take a short break here and ask you to tell me what you think. I mean, I assume a lot of you are familiar with the early Socratic dialogues, what I was just calling the aporetic dialogues that end without any satisfactory definition. What do you think the moral is that we're supposed to draw from the fact that they don't conclude with any definition? Did you raise your hand?
Yeah, okay. I'll just take a stab that the search for knowledge doesn't end, that you need it continues, it's ongoing.
Okay.
Maybe it could be a potential message that you should never stop, you should always.
Although they do stop.
Continue. Well, yeah, but if you say that it's puzzlement, that it mm-hmm. Okay. Well, maybe that's not such a good answer.
No, I'm just pressing you a little bit. I'm not trying to shut you down. Yeah. Oh, I thought someone over here had their hand up. I know you didn't come here to be students, but I mean, I think anyone interested in Plato and Socrates has to be struck by the fact that over and over, as Socrates searches for these definitions in the early dialogues, they don't come up with anything, and the dialogue ends, and then what? I don't know. What are we supposed to conclude from that?
Maybe it's too difficult. And if you gave a definition, you can find an example too that doesn't fit in this definition, and you start again. Mm-hmm.
That sounds sort of like what Wittgenstein might have thought, although it doesn't sound to me like what Socrates or Plato might have thought, but I don't know. I mean, that's why I'm throwing this out there, because I don't myself know.
It's either difficult or impossible. Mm-hmm. It's one of the two, I think.
Mm-hmm. Or it could be that Plato wants the reader to come up with an answer on the basis of what has been discussed there before.
Mm-hmm.
Or it could be that the answer lies in the esoteric teaching, and this is the exoteric teaching showing that it's impossible if you aren't part of the...
using my former self against me,
comes in the afternoon lecture.
Any other thoughts?
Best answer recorded.
Okay, so... when Wittgenstein himself was discussing the Socratic dialogues with his friend Con Drury, sometime around 1930, Drury said, it may be significant that those dialogues in which Socrates is looking for precise definitions end all of them without any conclusion. The definition he is looking for isn't reached, but only suggested definitions refuted. This might have been Socrates' ironical way of showing that there was something wrong in looking for one exact meaning of such general terms. That's what Drury said to Wittgenstein. And that's kind of like what Wilhelm was suggesting, I think, that this is supposed to show there's something wrong with the search for. So you're Drury, I guess. Unfortunately, Wittgenstein doesn't pick up on this suggestion from Drury or respond to it directly, so we don't know what he thought about it. But he did hear that as a possibility. So I said that early dialogues generally end in puzzlement with no definition found. One might conclude that there is no definition to find. That's what Wilhelm has suggested. Or one might conclude that we just have not tried hard enough. I guess maybe that's a little bit some of these other answers here that you have to, you know, the reader has to keep going on their own. Or perhaps that Socrates feels like, you know, if only we had more time, we could get to the definition. I think that's kind of what I conjecture, that the early dialogues break off because the people he's talking with have other business to attend to. Socrates wanted to hang in there and keep at it, and I think Socrates thought that if only they could, they would eventually come up with something. This latter conclusion seems to me to be the one that Socrates prefers. The dialogues often end inconclusively because those people Socrates is talking with basically run out of patience. And it's interesting to look at the early dialogues and see the dramatic context in which they end. For example, the end of the Euthyphro. Euthyphro says, "Some other time, Socrates, for I'm in a hurry now and it's time to go." And in the Protagoras, at 361e, Protagoras says, "We will examine these things later, whenever you wish. Now it is time to turn our attention elsewhere." And in the Republic, this is in the first book of the Republic, but at 331d, where Cephalus, he's the first person that Socrates sort of drills about the nature of justice, Cephalus bows out, saying, "I'll hand over the argument to you, as I have to look after the sacrifice." Even though he had just come from the sacrifice, and I think this was just his excuse for getting out of the discussion. And at the end of the symposium, well, the symposium is not an early aporetic dialogue, but if any of you remember the ending of the symposium, Socrates drinks all of his companions under the table, and then he goes off to spend the day as usual, as the sun is rising, while the other people he's been talking to are just laying out drunk on under the table. This ending, actually, of the symposium is not unlike Wittgenstein himself. His teacher, Bertrand Russell, related how when Russell first knew Wittgenstein, so this was like 1912, when Wittgenstein first would come to talk to Russell, Russell says, "He used to come to see me every evening at midnight and pace up and down in my room like a wild beast for 3 hours in agitated silence. I did not like to suggest to him that it was time for bed." So, in a way, Wittgenstein himself sounds like Socrates having drunk his companions under the table at the symposium. But it's interesting that, dramatically speaking, these early dialogues end basically by people getting tired of the search and having other things to do. So it's not really that Socrates has brought them to an end or that Socrates is satisfied that they have ended, but people just run out of patience. Okay, the former conclusion there isn't really a definition to be found, Wilhelm's conclusion, seems to be the conclusion that Drury reached, that there is no definition to be found. But after all, there's no way to show that a particular term is indefinable. Think about that. How could you show that a term was indefinable? At most, there could be inductive evidence for such a conclusion. You know, this attempt fails, that attempt fails, that attempt fails, so therefore what? Well, I mean, that's kind of a weak induction. Three failures, therefore no possible success. But that's kind of the situation we're in. And if you think about G.E. Moore's book, Principia Ethica, where Moore argues that there is no naturalistic definition of goodness, what does Moore do? He offers about three or four possibilities, shoots them all down, and then concludes, so there's no definition. But, you know, that's a pretty weak argument when you think about it. They all fail Moore's open test argument as the method he uses, but he doesn't have any proof that all possible definitions would have to fail that test. So Moore himself offers no reason to suppose all proposed definitions must fail the test. The Republic, though, let me getting around to Plato's dialogue of the Republic. The Republic, though, is an interesting dialogue in part precisely because it does reach a definition, in particular a definition of justice. Not at the end of book one. I don't know if you're familiar with scholarship about the Republic, but some people have thought that book one of the Republic had originally stood on its own as an early dialogue, as an aporetic dialogue. It does end in some puzzlement. They certainly have not defined justice by the end of book one. But, you know, the Republic is actually 10 books. And by the end of the fourth book, they have come up with a definition of justice that all the interlocutors seem to accept. You know, it's a definition of justice in terms of each part doing its own proper job and not interfering with the other parts. And I'm not saying that we should accept this as a good definition, but the interlocutors, at any rate, in the dramatic context of the dialogue, seem to accept this. But it has taken a good four books to reach this point of a satisfactory definition. So to me, this is at least some evidence for the interpretation that Socrates himself felt that if we had just stuck with it long enough, if we had enough patience, we could perhaps ultimately come up with a definition. And in the Republic, after four books, we do, or at least they do, in a way that looks somewhat plausible. So this may be evidence that a satisfactory definition is not impossible to find, but just hard to find. And it leaves open the possibility that G.E. Moore just did not try hard enough to define good, and Wittgenstein did not try hard enough to define game. Maybe if he went on for four volumes of the Philosophical Investigations, he'd have a definition of game. I don't know. But I think Wittgenstein would not want to formulate his difference with Socrates as being over whether there really is a satisfactory, essential definition of game. Rather, I think Wittgenstein would want to put his difference with Socrates as being over whether there must be a satisfactory, essential definition, or whether there has to, you know, whether there needs to be a satisfactory essential definition of game. It's not that Wittgenstein tires of the search, as the interlocutors in the early dialogues did, but rather Wittgenstein is willing to rest content without achieving the outcome that Socrates seeks. Socrates seeks to keep pushing until you find an essential definition, and Wittgenstein, I think, is willing to say, no, that's enough. We don't need all of that. Having a sense of family resemblance, an interconnected network of similarities, that's enough. The same pattern of difference between Socrates and Wittgenstein seems to emerge in another context, too. On December 17, 1930, while Wittgenstein was in Vienna between academic terms, Wittgenstein met with Moritz Schlick to discuss Schlick's just-published book, Problems of Ethics. And according to Weismann's notes of the meeting between Wittgenstein and Schlick, Wittgenstein said the following. Schlick says that in theological ethics, there used to be two conceptions of the essence of the good. According to the shallower interpretation, the good is good because it is what God wants. According to the profounder interpretation, God wants the good because it is good. I think, here, this is Wittgenstein speaking, I think that the first interpretation is the profounder one. What God commands, that is good, for it cuts off the way to any explanation why it is good, while the second is the shallow rationalistic one, which proceeds as if you could give reasons for what is good. Wittgenstein says, the first conception says clearly that the essence of the good has nothing to do with facts and hence cannot be explained by any proposition. If there is any proposition expressing precisely what I, Wittgenstein, think, it is the proposition, what God commands, that is good. It would be hard to find a clearer statement of Euthyphro's position. So if you think back to the dialogue Euthyphro, this is exactly the position that Euthyphro is taking in that dialogue. And here, Socrates is endorsing Euthyphro's position, not Socrates' position. So let me retrace some of what happens in the Euthyphro on this issue. In the Platonic dialogue of the Euthyphro, after Euthyphro has proposed the view that the pious is what all gods love, Socrates asks him this following question of conceptual priority. Socrates asks him, is the pious being loved by the gods because it is pious? Or is it pious because it is being loved by the gods? And if you follow sort of modern moral philosophy, you know that this issue that Socrates is formulating here is the question about the divine command theory of ethics. The divine command theory of ethics is that things are right and wrong just because God says so. And the other side, you might say, of the issue is that God commands things or forbids them because they themselves have some ethical status of being independently right or wrong. So Socrates is asking this question of conceptual priority, trying to get Euthyphro to see what the possibilities are. And it's clear what Euthyphro should say in answer to this question, given the position he's been taking, that it is pious because it is being loved by the gods. This is just what Wittgenstein has asserted. But Euthyphro, in that dialogue, does not really understand the question that Socrates has put to him. After a marginally helpful explanation from Socrates, though, Socrates returns with the question, now, Euthyphro, is it being loved, then, because it is pious, or for some other reason? Now, this is clearly a trick question that Socrates is putting to Euthyphro, because he's excluding the position that Euthyphro had been trying to advocate. Socrates is insisting here, you know, does God command it because it's pious or for some other reason? Socrates is slipping in the assumption that there must be some reason behind the gods' point of view, behind the gods' command. It's clearly a trick question because it builds in the presupposition that it's being loved for some reason or other. Euthyphro does not notice the trick, and so Euthyphro quickly answers, for no other reason. Euthyphro does not have... For after all, if you have to come up with a reason why God commands this or that, that seems the most plausible one. And then when Socrates draws out the unfortunate implication for his view that Euthyphro's answer here has now contradicted the position he took earlier, Euthyphro responds, apparently. But Euthyphro sees something has gone wrong, but he can't put his finger on what it is. The trick that Socrates has played on him, the presupposition that he builds in, is precisely the hidden assumption that many of us would accept, that the gods act for reasons, that commands can be justified. But Euthyphro should have responded, for no reason at all, Socrates. That's the position that he had been advocating. And that response cuts off the way to any explanation why it is good. Socrates, I think, is so gripped by the urge to justify that either he does not himself see that he's presupposing that, or else he is cynically using but concealing that presupposition against Euthyphro. In Wittgenstein's diary, not long after the discussion I've just quoted between him and Schlick, Wittgenstein writes, "It is good because God commanded it. That's the right expression for the lack of reason." So anyway, so now I've set up another sort of debate between Wittgenstein and Socrates, where again Wittgenstein takes the position of Socrates' interlocutor against the position of Socrates. Here again we see the accuracy of Wittgenstein's remark that I quoted earlier. I can characterize my standpoint no better than by saying it's the opposite standpoint to the one occupied by Socrates in the Platonic dialogues. So Wittgenstein stands with Euthyphro and the divine command theory in ethics, where Socrates insists on a reason behind the commands. Wittgenstein is whereas Socrates insists on a reason behind the commands, Wittgenstein is willing to rest content without achieving the outcome that Socrates seeks. So I think, again, we have this sort of same pattern of difference between Socrates and Wittgenstein. The question when to press or when to halt the process of explanation or justification comes up in a variety of contemporary philosophical discussions, too. And I just mention one raised by Thomas Nagel, who's a contemporary American philosopher. Nagel has an interesting discussion of this issue as it relates to the meaning or absurdity of life. And Nagel says the ability to step back from our life and press for a justification of our activities is one of the things that makes us most human. You know, we can stand back and say, well, why am I trying to get a PhD in philosophy? Or, you know, why am I doing this job? Or why do I want to have a family? We can all, whatever it is that we're doing, we can always step back from it. And this makes us, makes us human. Squirrels just chase acorns or chase other squirrels or whatever. Squirrels don't stand back and say, why am I chasing acorns? Or why should I chase that other squirrel? Squirrels just live. They just do it, so to speak. Humans can live and do it, but they also have this capacity to step back from our life and press for a justification of our activities. This is one of the things that makes us most human, according to Nagel. And this is, indeed, I think, exactly what Socrates has in mind when he says in the Apology at 38a, he says, the unexamined life is not worth living for a man or for a human being. Right? If you just live but don't examine what you're doing, you're not being fully human. The unexamined life is fine for a squirrel, just chasing acorns or whatever they do, but if you as a human being don't examine your life, you're not really living any more than a squirrel is. You're not living a fully human life, I think Socrates thinks. But what Nagel points out is that there's a kind of absurdity that results from this perpetual possibility of regarding everything about which we are serious as arbitrary from a larger perspective. You know, we can always stand back from something we're doing and wonder about it. And Nagel's thought is that this capacity to always bring into question what you're doing leads ultimately to absurdity. You know, when would you stop? Nagel thinks that this collision within ourselves, as he calls it, is best faced with a sense of irony. The only way to avoid this sort of collision of self-consciousness, Nagel says, would be either never to attain it, that is to say, this sense of self-consciousness, or to forget it, neither of which can be achieved by the will. You know, you can't sort of will yourself to not ask questions or will yourself to forget questions that you've raised. But here, I can imagine, we would again find Wittgenstein at odds with Socrates on this point. Socrates doesn't know when enough is enough, we might say. Socrates doesn't know when to stop. Whereas Wittgenstein says, he says this in the Zettel, but he also says it in lectures, he says the difficulty here is to stop. You know, stop the pursuit of explanation or whatever. While the unexamined life may not be worth living, the endlessly examined life, on the other hand, is not livable. You can't live a life endlessly examining everything that you undertake. There has to be some stop to that. Nagel says that once the issue is raised, we cannot forget it through an act of will. But I think what one can do is willingly submit oneself to a process that might predictably lead one to forget it or care less about it. And I think that's why those of us who are not obsessed by questions like this, you know, about the meaning of life or the justification of what you're doing, they usually react to people who are obsessed with questions like this by saying something like, get a life, right? Get a life is a way of, you know, getting your attention off these self-reflective questions. And I think that really is what Wittgenstein would want us to do in one way or another, is find a way to get a life, to not be obsessed with explanation, not be obsessed with justification in these cases. So we find several ways in which Wittgenstein is clearly at odds with Socrates. In each of these cases, it is because Socrates wishes to push questions further than his interlocutors and to find something deeper. And in each case, Wittgenstein is willing to rest content with something less, I believe. In certain ways, I think this brings Wittgenstein closer to Plato. So now I want to switch and talk about Plato some. I think an important way in which Plato differs from his mentor, Socrates, is that Plato came to think that Socrates' approach to issues was excessively intellectual. It made too little room for the rest of, or the whole human being. In particular, it left too little room for the emotions. So it is that, for example, that Plato's so-called middle dialogues had mythical stories in them. And it's interesting, Wittgenstein had a conversation with a friend of his, Utz Bausma, in 1950, and Bausma reports in the conversation, Wittgenstein reads Plato, the only philosopher he reads, but he likes the allegories, the myths. I was surprised to read that because it is not obvious to me that that's what Wittgenstein would like about Plato's dialogues. Perhaps in the myths, Wittgenstein saw a sort of different way of approaching philosophical issues than the way Socrates approached them, and the way that, you know, philosophers often approach them. In a passage that I quoted yesterday in my talk, it could be that in the myths, Wittgenstein saw the quite different artillery that he sought but never found in trying to address philosophical issues himself in his own work. And here's a passage that I wanted to quote yesterday but had trouble finding it. Eloise finally found it for me, but Wittgenstein wrote in 1933, I believe I summed up where I stand in relation to philosophy when I said, really one should write philosophy only as one writes a poem. That, it seems to me, must reveal how far my thinking belongs to the present, the future, or the past, for I was acknowledging myself with these words to be someone who cannot quite do what he would like to be able to do. So it could be that it's Plato's, you know, other ways of approaching philosophical issues that especially interest Wittgenstein, who was himself looking for other ways to approach them. One striking similarity between Plato and Wittgenstein is that both employ the dialogue format. Plato, almost always. Wittgenstein, at least sometimes, apparently in the Philosophical Investigations. There's been a great deal of work on characterization in Plato's dialogues. Ruby Blundell and other people have written whole books on character in Plato. And a whole book has been written on the people who were, on who the people were that made appearances in the dialogues. Deborah Nail's book, The People of Plato, is just about all the interlocutors and who they were and the significance of this. The dialogue format makes clear how philosophy is for Socrates an ad hominem activity. That is to say, it's a one-on-one activity of what you believe. Socrates is not interested in philosophical theories in the abstract. He's interested in what a particular person believes and how that fits with other things that person believes. This method of elenchus, is called in Greek, or refutation, only works to show the inconsistency of a set of beliefs all held by the same person. You know, so if I'm talking with Alois and I draw out his beliefs and find a contradiction in them, then that should mean something for him because it's supposed to have a special motivational force, since an inconsistent set of beliefs cannot all be true. And if I am one that holds all these beliefs, then I am holding at least one false belief. So the elenchus method is really a personalized way of doing philosophy. If, on the other hand, I were to try and refute you by showing that one of your beliefs was inconsistent with one of my beliefs, well, that needn't bother you very much, because although one of our beliefs has to be false, you might very well think, well, it's his belief that's false, so I don't have to care about that. But if I can show you that two of your beliefs are inconsistent with one another, that would have much more motivational force. And that's the approach that Socrates takes. But Plato's dialogue format is interesting for another reason. We generally know a good bit about Socrates' interlocutors, so we can see how emotion and circumstance can influence their beliefs. While Socrates himself seems to want his interlocutors to rise above these peculiarities of circumstance and attend to the pure rationality of the argument, The reader can see the limitations of this approach, and especially for readers who are familiar with ancient Greek history. In particular, Plato's own contemporary readers would have known of the people talking with Socrates, and it's possible to see how the views of the interlocutors held played out in their own lives. I just want to briefly mention one way that this happens in the Republic. In Book One of the Republic, if you think back to the discussion with Cephalus and Polymarchus about the nature of justice, Plato's readers would have known that Cephalus was an arms manufacturer in Athens, whose weaponry supplied Athens with the means to pursue its doomed ambitions in the war with Sparta. Of course, Cephalus was paid for these arms by the democratic regime, but he was giving what was owed to madmen, to the Athenian democrats, who were causing great harm through this otherwise just deal. So Cephalus has defined justice in Book One by saying it's telling the truth and giving back to people what is owed to them. It turns out that Cephalus is giving arms to the Athenian democrats. It's owed to them because they've paid him for them. But Socrates comes back with a sort of counterexample to this definition, and he says, well, what if what you owe to someone is a weapon, and what if that person you owe it to is a madman? Is it going to be just to give him his weapon back? And Cephalus says, well, of course, no. But that's exactly what Cephalus himself is doing in Athens. He's selling weapons justly to the Athenian democrats, who are using them to lead to the downfall of Athens in its war with Sparta. So what Plato has done is created this situation in which the character Cephalus undermines his own definition by his life. And then after Cephalus bows out of the discussion, his son Polymarchus takes over the discussion. And Polymarchus says, am I to inherit everything from you, Cephalus, including the argument? Well, it sounds a little funny, but it's extremely ironic because Polymarchus not only inherits the argument, he inherits the guilt of Cephalus, because although Cephalus passes away, when the 30 tyrants take over from the democrats in Athens, they put to death Polymarchus for having been a supporter of the democrats. And Polymarchus, you remember, defined justice as helping your friends and harming your enemies. And so Polymarchus dies because the government harms its enemies, namely Polymarchus, by executing him. So Cephalus and Polymarchus's definitions are both, in the dialogue context, undermined by the very dramatic context, by the very lives that they lead. And Plato builds this into the story. Now, we who read this don't necessarily know much about Cephalus and Polymarchus, but the people of Athens at that time would have known these things, and we're able to learn them if we study some ancient Greek history. But I think it shows us the richness of the dialogue format that Plato is using. Bousma quotes some more of his conversation with Wittgenstein about the Platonic dialogues, and Wittgenstein was kind of dismissive because he thought that Socrates' interlocutors were a bunch of yes-men. And I think that's often true, that the interlocutors don't put up much of a struggle sometimes. I do sympathize with his criticism of the interlocutors as yes-men. Wittgenstein says he doesn't really understand the irony that goes on in this case. And I think Wittgenstein's understanding of the irony of the dialogue is rather shallow. There is the surface irony, where Socrates patronizes his interlocutors, but there's also this deeper irony that I was just describing. You might call it Platonic irony, in which Plato undermines his interlocutors. And I think this is very much a part of the dialogic method. And it comes from Plato's wider understanding of the problems of argument. Socrates failed in his attempts to change people, but we can see that by the fact that people he tried to change end up executing him. You know, Socrates wasn't very effective changing people's minds, when you think about it, since they put him to death. Now let me talk about Wittgenstein and then end. Wittgenstein does not write in an obviously dialogic fashion, but at least some of the philosophical investigations lends itself to that interpretation. For occasionally there are lines put in quotation marks or between dashes, seeming to suggest another voice entering the train of thought. Stanley Cavell has called these the voice of temptation and the voice of correctness. And another researcher, David Stern, has claimed to identify yet a third voice that he calls the commentator or the ironic voice. Seeing the investigations as a sort of dialogue has not been straightforward, though, because it has very few of the markings of a dialogue. Most important, no characters are named. Names alone may accomplish rather little, though Deborah Nails does a lot with the historical associations of names mentioned in Plato's dialogues. But even made-up names would allow us to track who is speaking, and thereby allow us to gather comments from a given speaker together to form a kind of point of view. You know, if Wittgenstein had at least labeled who these voices were, we could kind of put them together and formulate points of view. Wittgenstein, though, not only names no speakers, but while he does use some markers, such as quotation marks and so forth, which are taken to identify a voice, he does not use them even consistently, I would say. I should ask some of the scholars here whether they agree with me, whether Wittgenstein consistently uses quotation marks and dashes to indicate interlocutors, but I think that he does not. I think sometimes there's an alternate voice quoted, but sometimes an alternate voice is just voiced, it's not quoted. And this makes it harder to make the case that there are three voices or any certain number of voices. And so this is a problem both in students who study Plato's dialogues and students who study the philosophical investigations. I don't know if you teachers or students have experienced this, but students will often say, well, Wittgenstein said so-and-so. And I'll say, yeah, but that's really an alternate voice. That's not what Wittgenstein is saying. Or, Plato is saying so-and-so. Yeah, well, Socrates said that, but that's not necessarily what Plato meant to be conveying. So there are lots of, you know, complications in dialogic circumstances. One might well think that the voices in the investigations are not, after all, different characters or people, but different inclinations within oneself. I think that's often how it's construed. If this were so, then it might well be difficult to separate and identify them. That might take a sort of psychoanalysis as to, you know, where that voice is coming from. But even if Wittgenstein thought these various voices were in all of us, he also presumably supposes that a certain voice is stronger in some of us, and another voice is stronger in others. And I believe this is much closer to the situation myself, since Wittgenstein makes such a big deal about the fact that other people will not understand him. And I used this illustration in answer to a question yesterday, but in trying to understand whether the various voices in Wittgenstein's investigations are just within himself, or ourselves, or, you know, are other people voicing something to him, I think it's useful to think whether you're imagining Wittgenstein primarily, you know, writing by himself in his study, or whether you're imagining him leading a class in which other people are interacting with him. The one image leads to the idea that there are just voices in his head. The other image leads to the idea that it's more of an interchange. A value of at least somewhat dialogic character of the investigations is that it means to address some of the non-cognitive aspects of belief formation and argumentation, and to personalize that address. And this is what I called yesterday Wittgenstein's evangelism. And in my previous talk that I'd given, it has to be noted that in the preface to the investigations, Wittgenstein confesses that he did not find the book to be successful, and he had given up on trying to improve it. But one might wonder how it could be changed or improved. What sort of changes might have made the difference that Wittgenstein was looking for? Would they have been maybe giving fuller characterization to these other voices that he brings in to the investigations? So to conclude, in the so-called ancient quarrel between philosophy and poetry, you remember this line from the Republic, it's at 607b, Plato alludes to the ancient quarrel between philosophy and poetry, I think we can see Wittgenstein wishing to side against Socrates, but I would say with Plato, who found ways of making philosophy poetic. But the problem is Wittgenstein expresses the feeling that he is unable to participate in the quarrel except on Socrates' terms.